Test, test. This is David Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute at the Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. And today is August 3rd, 1989. And today we're privileged to be talking with and interviewing Mr. Virgil N. M. Exner, Jr. What does the M stand for, Mr. M-A-X, Virgil Max Exner, Jr. Mr. Exner has had a long career as a designer, mainly with the Ford Motor Company, and automotive designer, and of course is the son of the celebrated Virgil Exner, Virgil M. Exner, Sr. We'll talk today with Mr. Exner about his career, and his design career, and about his relationship with his father. And since he has unique perceptive growing up with and working with and being the son of a famous designer, we would like him to speak as detailed fashion as possible about what he has perceived over the years of his father's career and how his father's career has impacted on the history of automotive design. So we'll ask Mr. Exner to give his career narrative in his own way.
Okay, thank you very much, Dave. It's a privilege on my part to be here, and I want to thank you for our association over the last year, couple of years here, especially while I was at Ford Motor Company in design, and finally got around to making this interview. As Dave said, I'd like to pretty much go through my father's biography on a chronological basis. It naturally impacts my own career a great deal. And so I may as well start with basically when he was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, September 24th, 1909. And was at that time put up for adoption as having available for that purpose, and was adopted by the Exners approximately shortly after his birth at Ann Arbor Hospital. The Exners renamed him. He was originally born to a couple with the background name of Little and Anderson, thus being basically Scots and Norwegian ancestry. And perhaps he may be looked upon as getting some of his eventual design aplomb and sensitivity from the particularly the Scandinavian side of that combination. Nevertheless, the Exners, an old German name, and in Buchanan, Michigan, adopted my father virtually from birth, and his name became Virgil Max. Why the Max? We never knew. Exner and the son of Iva and George Exner. My grandfather Exner was pretty much a do-it type of a person from a craftsman standpoint and from a inventive, creative type of person himself, and encouraged my father growing up at a very early age to be able to more or less handle all facets of shop making and woodworking and working with his hands. But he was my own father was really more of the nature of more of the artistic type, and with my grandmother's urgence, and of course being the only child, from a protective standpoint, more or less, wanted my father to pursue the fine arts rather than getting his hands a little bit greasy. My grandfather was a good machinist and worked for many years as one of the head machinists at the Clark Equipment Company in Buchanan, Michigan, which was the national headquarters of that company for many years. Buchanan was just a small town of about 5,000 that on the western side of the state, and only about 10 miles from 10 to 15 miles north of South Bend, Indiana, which of course is the home of the University of Notre Dame. My father grew up quite normally and had many local hometown friends and went to Buchanan High School, graduated at age of 16, and very early on had not any particular formal art training, but did develop to become, for instance, the Buchanan High School yearbook editor, or not editor, but art editor, and did a number of sketches and whatnot, and was always known for painting signs and doing things like that of that nature around Buchanan, Michigan, while he was in his high school years. He was just as a boy in his boyhood, the neighborhood friends. One of his best friends, Art Allen, in Buchanan, who was one of our family's lifelong friends, of course, was interested in guns and the Old West and all kinds of romantic type of notions that boys at that time obviously went through. My father soon became very fascinated with automobiles and grew up with quite a passion for both the aesthetic appeal and the mechanical appeal of the car. Even before while he was still in high school, he and his friend Art and a couple of the other fellows would go over to Chicago from time to time on the train and go to the auto shows, and my father in particular seemed to be quite fascinated by the magnificence of the shows, and even one time along with Art crawled through a barrier to see a car that was a brand new type of car that was on display, which happened to be called a Duesenberg, back in the early 20s, and was the Model A Duesenberg, of course. At any rate, he was always impressed by that, and even during his early teens, as well as doing fine art sketches and fine art work, he started to draw cars and to actually design the bodies, of which I have a couple of his very early sketches that he portrayed a couple of Model A Duesenbergs and a design for a Kissel Roadster. But at any rate, he soon graduated from Buchanan School, Buchanan High School. He had just a very smattering of artistic training in any way. At that time, then decided that he would go to university as a day student. The family was not Catholic in any way, but nevertheless, the University of Notre Dame was close by so that he could commute. And he and his model. Okay, at any rate, my father and his rather fanciful painted Model T Ford took off, and he went to day school and enrolled in the College of Arts and Letters at the University of Notre Dame approximately 1926, after having graduated from Buchanan High in 1925. For a period of about 2.5 years, again with very little art training, because the school was not a strong artistic school, but there were a couple of art classes, design and just basic art design, and and just a little tiny bit of advertising art that was taught there. It was primarily fine art, drawing and painting, typical of the the Catholic type institution. And so pardon?
The Enlightened.
Well, somewhat, you might say that. Again, my father was not Catholic in any way. My grandparents were quite independent. My grandmother really was a Church of Latter-day Saint. And,
really?
Actually.
That's
and, yeah. And never
imposed it on
my father in any way. And my grandfather, he was quite a normal individual. At that time, Protestant, but not heavily involved in any church. So they supported him along with his own efforts, working as a more or less picking up a little bit of work as doing sign painting around Buchanan and whatnot to a certain extent to help his way through school, and they picked up. The majority of his tuition fee at that time. Well, this worked for about 2.5 years, and it got to the point where funding was kind of running out, and it was getting more expensive. And he really only attended the university and did very, very well, but was advised. In his regular academic courses and whatnot, he had very high grades. And did as well as he could as far as picking up the artistic end, and was advised, frankly, by the head of the department at that time that they couldn't teach him very much more as far as a professional to become a professional artist in any way, which he was then by then very interested in, and advised him that that perhaps it was best if he. If he tried to secure a job around the fringe of advertising art at that time. And so he quit school in 1928, did not graduate, and started work for a firm in South Bend, right there in South Bend, called Advertising Artists. This firm was advertising studio branch of the then quite widely established Meinzinger Studios, which had its head offices in Detroit and in Chicago, and was at that time run by a fellow named Frank C. Foote, and Ed Clark in South Bend, located right downtown. And they held accounts in South Bend, their office in South Bend, Advertising Artists, held the accounts of such firms as Studebaker Corporation, their main account for doing their advertising catalogs and advertising artwork leading to the catalogs, and as well as Foote, Frank C. Foote. Their accounts also were some of the musical instrument which were largely concentrated in nearby Elkhart, Indiana, such as Kahn instruments.
COWN.
Right.
The other one that was very famous.
Well, let's see. Kahn was one of the most,
big one, yeah.
But it was Blessing. Mm-hmm. Blessing was one of them. Though I think they were a branch, really, of Kahn. But there was another one there too.
Some reason those two well-known firms ended up in Elkhart.
And then some of the other accounts were typical local breweries, like Berghoff, which was Fort Wayne, Indiana.
B-E-R-G-H-O-F-F,
yep. Clark Equipment Company, of course, right there in Buchanan, as well as various other typical type office equipment accounts and things like that. So at any rate, my father was advised to try that and knocked on the door and was actually ushered in for an interview as an errand boy to start with by my mother, who was the who was then the newly hired office secretary of Ed Clark there at the advertising agency. My mother having come to South Bend from Three Rivers, Michigan, a family of about one son and three daughters, and both my mother and her younger sister, being the youngest of the family, were sent off to South Bend to go to secretarial college by my uncle, the oldest son of the Eshelman family, my mother's maiden name,
being
Eshelman, E-S-H-L-E-M-A-N,
okay.
In from basically from Nottoway, Michigan, farmers for the most part. My grand
what town was that?
Nottoway. That's where my mother was actually born. Nottowa, N-O-T-A-W-A.
W-A?
Yeah,
Nottowa.
And was close by Three Rivers, Michigan. My mother went to high school in Three Rivers. As I said, they were sent off to go to college, business college in South Bend Business College by my uncle, who had taken over the family because my actual, my grandfather on my mother's side had died at a very early age. It was my my uncle that that took over the family at that time with my grandma Ashma. So at any rate, when my father showed up at Advertising Artists, it was really my mother that did the physical hiring with the paperwork and whatnot. But my father became an errand boy to begin with.
Typical of those days.
Yep, typical of those days. Really. Apprenticeship,
right.
and was happy to get the job and then to be around watching artists there at work the type of errands that he did was to deliver artwork and prints and all kinds of things like that to the companies, but it was primarily Studebaker that they needed that type of liaison with, and he got to know more or less the design engineering department at Studebaker, and this furthered his interest in cars.
What year was this again?
This was in approximately 1928-1929. And of course the Depression came along at that time, and that hit very hard, and that one of the reasons that that he more or less could not continue or foresee the continuance of going to college. So it was important that he had this job, and I remember both my mother and my father telling me that when I was a little kid myself, that they worked long hours there, and then my father got on the board and actually started to do a little bit of illustration, advertising art under Frank Foote and Ed Clark.
Yeah.
They worked him into the boards to actually start to do some work.
So obviously recognize his talent.
Yeah, they started to recognize his talent as he started to discuss things with him, talk about things, show them some of the work that he had done and things like that. Both he and my mother was making more money than he was. My mother was making $11.44 a week. It wasn't too bad at all, but it's still really something else. I mean, my father was far less than that, just starting out. So at any rate, and that kept up for some time, for a few years at those kind of wages anyway. But he soon started to work out quite well on his own as far as being able to handle some of the major work. He started out doing backgrounds to a great extent for some of the car illustrations, then started to do some of the car illustrations himself for both the Studebaker truck and the car, and then worked in the complete advertising layout brochures and full-size illustrations, or not full-size car illustrations, but full-size brochure illustrations, and worked into the complete range of things, as well as cars, of course, worked out some of the major brochures for some of their major accounts. He did not really become a senior artist, but at least, or any kind of a managerial standpoint, anything like that. They just didn't have things like that. But he became one of the full associate artists within a couple of years, and as I said, became really responsible for some of the major brochure work, of which I have a few samples left from that time.
What can you tell us at this point about his personality? Was the photographs show that he's tall and handsome?
Yes, he was skinny, relatively tall, 5'10 and a half, 5'11. Dark hair, very dark hair, rather light complected, always had somewhat of a high receding hairline, and was built not too unlike a tennis player type individual.
Rangy,
he's been a bit rangy like that. He liked sports, although my grandmother, even back in the high school days, kind of poo-pooed that. My grandfather wanted to see him be a football player, and he wanted to be a football player. But my grandma actually was a little bit up in arms about that. And although he was an avid sports enthusiast, and he actually, while he was at the University of Notre Dame, went out for track there. But did not make the team in any way, but was participated in at least some of the intramural sports.
Was he gregarious? Was he?
Overall, I would say he was quite gregarious. His personality was have heard him tell it when he was a child. He was a kind of a daring kid especially with he and art, were kind of. Full of prank, Art Allen. At the Allens owned the local hardware store there in Buchanan for years and years and years, and they were good friends. And at any rate, they were kind of prankish type of kids. He liked the girls in high school and whatnot. Although, to show his car interest in those days, his girlfriend's name was Mercedes. In high school, in his senior year, and the people of course, all the kids, just like kids today, everybody likes cars,
they were
a lot different, more and varied makes in those days too.
Just
incredible.
What about his? How did it first manifest itself? You told us a bit about how he was able to parlay it into a job. I think you've indicated that he was interested in fine art, but his actual physical dexterity and able to translate what he saw into something more than just a sketch. It was obviously somewhere along the line he picked up.
He nurtured the idea of designing things general. I think as part of the. As part of the background that he perhaps got from my grandfather, who was always building things on the side, and my grandfather was purely a builder type, a constructor type, but not that much of a designer. But he would build his own furniture, turn his own wood legs for tables, and make. Small amounts of furniture and things like that. I think my father picked up on the idea of his artistic combining that with making something when he would make his own swords to fight with the other kids, and his would always be beautifully carved and break instantly. But he always perceived the idea of when he did make something and he could make a lot of things. He could do things very well with his hands.
That's
he was not only a good draftsman, but He was a good craftsman and perceived how craftsmanship should proceed, I think.
Wonderful combination.
And mechanically especially, he had a sense for mechanical beauty, and so this, just with his artistic ability, he could be very fluid in his draftsmanship and painting, he liked mechanical beauty also, or at least had an eye for that sort of thing. So it was a natural to work into about the only thing that really existed at that time as far as the industrial design is concerned was the advertising aspect of art or the or architecture. There was very little in the way of any kind of school to be had for any type of industrial design. It was a 20th century phenomenon, really. And it was that you went to your local university and they had art courses, and then art, which was a good background because, I mean, after all, that leads to everything. At least he got a little bit of training there. But largely he was self-taught from both a drafting standpoint, and you could see how drafts were made perhaps by seeing engineers working at Studebaker, and could see how that was done, he was able to use that ability. I guess he had a little bit of mechanical drawing at the University of Notre Dame. But largely was just felt comfortable with a pencil and a straight edge and or a paintbrush and whatever type of media that was available.
Obviously, quick studies.
Yes, quick sketches. He was extremely versatile, and I think that this is something as well as the ability to sculpt things. He was able to master these mediums very easily, it's difficult to judge exactly what his best medium really would be, although it leaned most heavily towards a transparent watercolor. Which was largely of large interest in the 1920s, and it was something that was quite popular in the 1920s, but he was particularly adept at that, and later on in his life, then he even picked up even while he was at Chrysler. Picked back up on that, and it was very much his first love. So even some of the illustrations that were done for advertising art during this period of time while he was there were transparent watercolor illustrations for even cars or whatever it was. Approximately 1931, he started to date my mother there. It took him a while to get up some nerve, I guess, they were married in 31. And
tough year for young married to start out.
It certainly was. But they had a good time. And by that time, my father had acquired a Model A Ford. Model A Ford Roadster.
Yeah.
It was a tan job with, I believe it was, he told me it was black fenders, and he painted the wheel Charisse. And it was a real sharp looking rig, apparently. Yeah. But at any rate, then he proceeded to work there, And my mother actually, even while she had been going to, this was even before she herself started to work at the advertising artist there, my mother had gone to school at the Southern Business College, as I said. And while she was doing this, in order to raise tuition and whatnot, she and to cover her own room and board, had taken up a position with a rather large family as a housekeeper, build-in, live-in babysitter with a family there in South Bend. Later on went to Detroit themselves, then came back to South Bend, and they became both my father and mother's very best friends there, the Schaefer family that built the Schaefer Gearworks in South Bend.
Just spell that.
S-S-S-H-A-E-F-E-R. And so at any rate, my mother was actually living with the Schaefers and continued to live with them during the time that when she first started to work for the advertising agency, and that's where my father first started dating her, and then later on in like I say 1931 they were married, and rented their first house that they had initially from apartments, but then their first house together in a very small old-fashioned area in South Bend. Mm-hmm. It was a struggling times during the Depression years at that time, but they were doing quite well. And then and during this period of time, actually kept up contacts with my grandparents in nearby Buchanan, mm-hmm. and with my mother's family in Three Rivers, Michigan, and then during this time that my father was working various accounts, he was also more or less on the side, sort of always fiddling with sort of new car designs, and with the idea of designing really designing the lines of cars himself, and not just illustrating existing cars, but the idea was more and more appealing to him to do new advanced looking cars just for his own amusement more than anything else. He did not realize, and there wasn't too much of a call for other than at the various coach builders during those years. There wasn't too much of a call for actual art designers to do cars, but he had definite ideas about how cars he thought should look and what they would look like in the future. I might add that a very important part of his background and enthusiasm and interest, and it became an interest of the family. I was brought up with it almost all my life, and my mother was a great enthusiast too, and that is of automobile racing. Even at an early age, he was fascinated by racing cars. My grandfather was a little bit enthusiastic about that too, and would take him to any of the local type races, dirt track races in those days, and as early as the age of 16, he begged my grandfather to take him down to Indianapolis, and of course that was a big turn on him. And unfortunately, my grandfather was hit by a car while they were down there that first time and broke his leg, he was enthusiastic about it and liked the idea, he said he never wanted to go back there down there to Indianapolis again. But my father just loved it, and of course carried on and through the days of the early 30s, where it was late 20s, early 30s, where it was really the purest breeds of racing cars existed with the Duesenbergs and Millers and cars of those of that type of nature that were aesthetically beautiful and sounded good and ran fast. And and he was a great enthusiast of the sport. And he would, of course, hot rodded his own cars around through high school and even with his Model A Ford. Well, at any rate, in 1933, I was born in South Bend, Indiana, myself, and about that time, or just shortly after that time, it was really a couple of visits from the main branch in Detroit that that resulted in my father breaking away from the actual advertising art and coming up to Detroit and
in that, branch of
Meinzinger's.
Yeah.
And so it was really I can't remember who the individual was. It was one of the top-ranking persons up here that had been visiting occasionally the studios in South Bend, and had seen my father's work that he put up around his own design cubicle or drafting cubicle.
Can we spell Meinzinger, please?
M E I. N-Z-I-N-G-E-R, I believe. Okay, I think I'm sure that can be looked up. But at any rate, one of the individuals kept seeing some of these advanced car designs, and my father got a little tiny bit of publicity in that a couple of little home magazines and whatnot around the local Berrien County or around St. Joe County and down there in South Bend. Wanted to do one time an article on what would a futuristic car look like, and my dad did make a couple of little sketches and illustrations for him, and I have a copy of that, by the way.
Wonderful.
And really nice looking stuff, a nice pencil sketch as well as a black and white ink sketch. So he got a little bit of publicity there and to show off some of these what he thought advanced cars would look like. It was in late 1933 that he was told of the hiring that was going on the part of General Motors, and that he was advised that, gee, you ought to go up there and show some of those people that kind of thing, the kind of things that you're doing, and maybe you could perhaps get into a career of working into actual automotive design. This appealed to him greatly, and so he gathered a portfolio together of the work that he had done there, and especially the advanced car design. And it was advised to come up and see Harley Earl, who had been putting together the General Motors design styling section since 1926-27. And initially started out as the art and color section, of course, at General Motors. And so,
Does anyone family recall who advised him in that?
It was, again, it was whoever, there was a name at one time, and I just am afraid I've forgotten that. I think it could be found, you know.
He was with whom again?
Meinzinger Studios,
yeah, okay.
Here in Detroit. and was more or less the regional manager, at least, because like I say, advertising artist was a branch along with many other branches. They had quite a few branches throughout the Midwest. So at any rate, then my father went up to GM and met with Harley Earl, or at least with, I think it was both Mr. Earl and Howard O'Leary, I think, at that time. They were impressed with his work and offered him a job, which he was really tickled to death to get, starting off as a designer, a young designer, and they were gathering together a bunch of young designers. There was hardly any kind of formal training that was available for car designers per se in any way. So
this
was 1934, and so during that period of time, they had been stocking the art and color section with designers that had come from coach builders that were a lot of them going out of business,
right,
and whatnot.
Yeah.
During that period
of
time,
there was a large talent pool available.
There was, and GM got them, and then they supplemented them with young fellows like my father, a lot of them coming directly out of high school. Some of them had a little bit of a formal education, and some of them switched jobs from other places, came in from advertising businesses like my father, and at any rate,
very fluid and flexible in those days.
Oh yes, very much so, and not
formalized.
Not formalized in any way, and with the philosophy yet to be developed, and so it gave birth to a great variety of design, which General Motors was consciously at that time promoting. To make their products, each one of them, different, so it was just a natural pool that developed there. Well, initially, my father worked for Frank Hershey there at in the Pontiac. He was the head of the Pontiac studio, and he was assigned to Frank Hershey. And but at the same time, and this went on for only about a year, and. And there was a Harley Earl decided to put on a design contest within the General Motors studio network.
Did your father ever recall why this was done?
Pardon?
Did your father ever mention why he thought the Harley Earl initiated this contest? It seemed obvious why. He probably wanted to.
As I understand, the reason that he wanted to, didn't want to just test the capacity, I think that he honestly did want to put people in a competitive position. And not just within the studio, but inter-studio. And so I think that he wanted to. Also, I think he wanted to hold out as a reward the positions as heads of the studio at that time too, because it got down to a process of selection from that standpoint, some of the older fellows perhaps didn't have quite some of the creative ideas that Harley saw within the younger group. And so they had a contest, and some of the people that were around at that time, as well as my father that I can remember him talking about and whatnot, were at that time was Claire Hodgman, was certainly one of my, you might say, the young group that hung around together after my father and mother first came to Detroit.
C-L-A-A-R-E.
Yeah, Claire Hodgman, H-O-D-G-M-A-N. H-O-D-G-E-M-A-N.
Oh, there's an E in there.
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. But they hung around together. They were good friends, the Hodgmans, and being that that Claire and his sister, Clarice, were actually at originally from Jackson, Michigan.
Really?
Yep. And and so they were kind of small town oriented people all together, there was at that time, of course, Claire wasn't married, but his sister was always hanging around up in Detroit. It wasn't that far from Jackson to Detroit, and my mother and Clarice became very, very good friends, and Claire's sister. And then in addition, there was Paul Zimmerman, who was from an Easterner, actually an Austrian, that was quite a good designer, that was part of the more or less the clique of younger people at that time. Primarily those two, but
Gordon Buick.
No, Gordon was not at. I don't believe he was ever at General Motors. No, Bill Mitchell was. No, he. Yeah, at General Motors, some of this group of people, Bill Mitchell, as I said before, had not quite come in there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They became friends, and there was Carl Reynolds also that worked there, as well as of course some of the modelers of whom my father had was always friendly throughout all of his career. Was they were among his favorite people at all times. He appreciated their artistic ability and their sculpture ability, and he liked to do that himself. Some of his greatest friends were always the modelers, the clay modelers, and wood sculptors.
Very astute of him, because they were, that's where it all started.
Really, that's really true, and he appreciated the fact that they could execute in three dimensions the things that he himself and other people dreamed about in two dimensions,
right.
And always appreciated that, and there was never any rivalry there like there has been among many designers with the modeling model making faction.
And of course,
that's right. And of course, in those days, it was primarily wood mock-ups that were done in full-size work. However, GM did more or less start the large process of going through scale clay models with the old type of almost children's type of modeling clay initially.
It's been written in recent years that Harley Earl and his great modeler GM really pioneered that technique.
Yeah, for the most part, although I believe a bit of it was done at some of the coach builders before. At least the use of modeling clay was done at some of the other coach builders and a bit in Europe before it really.
It's a natural
happened.
Progression because children's modeling clay had been available for almost.
Yes. Yes, that's right, and that's all that there was, more of that type of clay, unless you got into a water-based clay, which was impossible to form any kind of finished surface that would hold the surface in any way.
Yeah.
So the use of oil-based clay was an important. Initially, it was used as a filleting material for wooden models more than anything else, and then it became more and more over the overall surface of the model, and then was finally yes, it was. So at any rate, those were some of the people that were there at that time, as well as some of the older designers. Like Frank Hershey and it became necessary as they were hiring more and more people to sort out echelons, to sort out areas of responsibility, and to establish more strongly the individual studios, namely Pontiac, Chevrolet, Cadillac, and Buick, with LaSalle being more or less a subdivision of Cadillac and not its own studio, and with Oldsmobile, and so it became necessary to more or less sort that out, and Harley's way of doing that was to hold this more or less in-house contest, and each designer that had relatively major responsibility worked up his own designs and model for this contest, and one of the winners was my father, and another one was Claire Hodgman, another one was Paul Zimmerman, and they were soon assigned not too long after that to be the heads. My father took over the Pontiac studio. Frank Hershey moved up at that time, I believe, to Buick or Cadillac, I think. I believe it was Cadillac studio. And my father took over in 1935 as the head of the Pontiac studio. And Claire Hodgman became head of Oldsmobile studio. Paul Zimmerman, I believe, was Chevrolet studio. The work that they had done, or that he had done, or worked on prior to that, even as late as 19 or as early as 1934, when he was first hired there, he did manage to do a little bit of work that influenced the 35, 36, 36 models of Pontiac, and among that was even though it was basically the overall managerial responsibility, being the studio head, who was Frank Hershey at that time, it was his team of designers, including my father in 1934-35, that did create the Pontiac Silver Streak.
Really?
And of course, Frank Hershey is known for that, but I believe that my father has given some specific credit as far as that's concerned too. And
very distinctive.
And it certainly is distinctive. You don't want to be known. It's like later on he was known as the Fin Man. You don't want if you want to be known as that or not. You know, as piling some chrome on cars was something that became taboo later on. But nevertheless, it was looked upon as quite a breakthrough at the time. After he became the head of the studio, then his large contribution was the 37-38 Pontiac, really, that was large. He was largely responsible, along with his own team of people, of having designed that car.
Very distinctive look about it.
Well, it was very slim. He always believed in and started to develop a philosophy of car design, of course. Mm-hmm. His modeler, incidentally, his chief modeler in the Pontiac studio was George Martin at that time, who later, along with his sons, made tremendous contributions to the industry in the sculptural field and clay modeling field in particular.
At what firm?
Of course, George was a GM and then later went out to Art Center in Los Angeles to become one of their first sculptor instructors out there, and about probably 10 or 15 years ago, maybe earlier than that. And Ronnie Martin, his son, became actually worked for my father at Chrysler, when he was young, and developed many fiberglass techniques, and as well as became a representative of Chavant clay in New Jersey, I believe, and built clay machines for them, and supplied Chrysler as a representative, was a supplier for them in clay modeling. Knew all types of methods of clay modeling, and promoted the material itself. At any rate, by 1938, my father had more or less had responsibility for the design of a complete car, had developed more or less a philosophy of design, which was, along with his own closest friends, were more or less in agreement about those things. And yes, of course, they were influenced by publications, automobile racing, anything to do with design, which was coming to the forefront and in the form more or less as a revolution of industrial design that was giving at that time a great deal more thought and giving rise to the more or less the, you might say, the modern industrial design concepts that we have today. It was a transitional period going from old flat high hooded straight angles full fenders, flowing fenders, automobile design, typical of the early 30s, and started rapidly turning into the more fully bodied, all steel body, incidentally, and as opposed to a combination of wood and steel, giving way to new mechanical and innovation in chassis, body, and total vehicle development as opposed to the early era, especially to the coach building days of the 20s and 30s, giving more and more to the design of mass production cars, especially the all-steel bodied mass production produced cars.
It was a remarkably, I hate to overuse this word, but mm-hmm. fluid time. They were
very fluid time
into the modern world of automotive bodied design.
Right. To very contemporary, very modern for that time, of course. It was dabbling with thoughts of aerodynamics, and it was dabbling with smooth shapes, with flowing, you might say, enveloping designs as far as the body is concerned, with certain amount of innovation in glass technology, in plastics technology, in all types of material inventions, and one of the things that, for instance, and in building in everything on the exterior of an automobile, even though there were still separate fenders and separate hoods and things like that, the idea of blending things together, building in, and especially a General Motors more or less overall philosophy at that time. You may attribute it to Harley Earl, but it was the idea of having a continuity of design, where each detail, be it a bumper, and that was considered a detail at that time, or a radiator ornament, or a door handle, or any type of a molding, such as there may be, may not be, that every piece of ornamentation, as little as there could be, would look like it was designed to go with the basic body itself, as well as every other detail. In other words, a continuity of design elements. Even in headlights, for instance, were more or less large details, but they were shaped and ornamented and designed to fit to the body, much like the taillight would be. They even looked like they were, one was a smaller version of the other, attached the same way, was sculpted the same way, with its, whatever particular shape it took, a bullet shape or whatever, or a flat, thin shape, looked like it belonged with its sister taillight. Bumpers looked like they were made to, designed to go with their counterparts, and various embellishments, design detail. Trunk handles were designed to look like they matched the door handles, and that was a very important part of General Motors' philosophy in particular at that time. Some of the other firms didn't pick up that quite, but there were notable exceptions. The Lincoln Zephyr was a very excellent example of that same philosophy at that period of time.
Do you think that the European influence in the early to mid-30s was ever acknowledged by your father, or did he just sort of absorb it as a general atmosphere?
Well, I think that the designers, and they became quite a group of people that were suddenly, that were aware of what was going on in Europe and as well as developments here in the United States. My father in particular became an enthusiast conscious of European design. Again, it was led to a certain extent with a great enthusiasm and curiosity about European racing cars.
Were they acknowledged leaders?
Yes, they were going through in the late 30s with the rise of Mercedes and the Germans in particular. Mercedes and Audi unions were putting out some of the most, and prior to that, the Italians with Alfa Romeo and Maserati were producing some of the most absolute streamlined, purposeful, most powerful racing cars in the world at that time. Although my father kept great tabs on Indianapolis, and my folks would go religiously every year to Indianapolis.
You mentioned the Zephyr. This is what triggered my train of thought. Mm-hmm. Would he have perhaps have known John Charta at Briggs?
He didn't particularly know him. Okay. No, he didn't. No, at that time.
Or would he have absorbed any of the of Charta's influences, like his earlier streamlined Stuckenberg and the Tatra from Czechoslovakia, things of that sort?
Some of my father's own, I would say, sketches and car designs of advanced nature, they didn't really embrace the Tatra type design that you're talking about, and the Maxim. Because he couldn't himself, I believe he would tell me that he couldn't justify that type of a shape on such as large a cars as we ourselves had at that time in this country, those were designs at that time, especially the Tatra, that was okay to do that to a Volkswagen type of size car. And
you really felt the constraints of American taste.
Yes, purposes. Well, there was constraints of American taste, but there was naturally always constraints of American engineering too, as far as chassis are concerned.
He always
felt that he was always an enthusiast of aerodynamics,
right.
and of being very honest as far as automobile design is concerned. His primary mission was always the idea to get people from point A to point B first. That was
right.
The most important thing.
And
then there were plenty of room left over for some exciting style and whatnot. But he always tried to be honest, what he would call honest, as far as his philosophy of what a car ought to look like. Even though he took great liberties himself at times, as did we all. But nevertheless, And he was always, his other continuous theme, he was always had a great spot in his heart for what would have become the real classics, of course, Longhoods and Duesenbergs and Packards and all kinds of cars like that, and special coach work and whatnot. At any rate, he and his friends, his closest friends, you might say that they were constantly buying up all of the foreign car magazines they could lay their hands on, of which the European car magazines were available here in Detroit. They all lived around the New Center area. Mm-hmm. Of course, GM Styling was located on the third floor of the General Motors building. Sure. They ate up automobile racing and racing car models and everything else, and were very enthusiastic. And my dad did some race car sketches, as did some of the other fellows. Were always doing that type of thing. And of course, I was just a little tiny kid at that time. My dad was trying to bring me up right, and he was always drawing me race cars when I was a little bitty kid, and making race car sounds for me and stuff like that. And my folks were very close together, and as I grew up, it was some time before I had brothers and sisters, in particular, I was included. I was born 1933. I saw my first dirt track race myself down in Jackson, Michigan, in 1936.
Oh, really?
And then during the time that my parents lived here in Detroit, he was at General Motors. Then they constantly were going out to 8 Mile Speedway, to the Speedway out at 8 Mile Road, where initially it was dirt track cars sprint type cars, we would call them today, on a 1/2 mile, and then it became a 1/4 mile track out there later on. Any type of racing was the big sport. He wasn't ever particularly interested in water sports and the water that the Detroit area had to offer, not until later on. And then
right.
He got very heavily, very, very heavily involved in that. But it was primarily car design. The hours were long, lots of overtime, typical General Motors pressure. And the
it
pay.
Worked even on holidays.
Oh, yes. The pay wasn't that great, and he did manage to become the head of the chief of the Pontiac studio at that time, and contributed a little bit when they had crash programs to various other products. I think he designed the 1939 Buick headlights for that particular front end. And a few other miscellaneous detail assignments that he was responsible for. Also during that time, it was quite interesting. I came across in digging through my father's things,
papers
and whatnot. I found the patents to the bumper grill,
really?
And the the integrated bumper grill that. The style shown on the patent is very similar to the 1940s, late 40s style of bumper grills that were.
Somebody went back and saw those drawings. And
well, they held the patents, and it was a functional patent. Was the idea was to take the air in through the bumper and actually shroud it to the radiator, and at any rate, the patent is. Was made in his name at that time. It was issued really after he had left General Motors and gone with Raymond Loewy in 1938, which was the next phase of his career. But this was a leftover from that period of time. And of course, regarding patents, when designers at that time worked for companies, nowadays you just sign a release that you don't get anything from that standpoint. Back in those days, the company had to do the patent research, issue the patent in your name, and then they paid you $1 officially. They gave you $1 to buy the patent for the corporation.
Right.
This is the way it was handled at that time. So that leads us up to the next phase of his career, which he was kind of.
Tell me, was he happy at Dillamore?
Generally speaking, yes, he was happy. He was.
What did you think of Harley Earl?
He liked Harley Earl very much, apparently he thought Harley liked him too. In fact, Harley tried to talk him out of just really practically cried when he left.
Elaborate on that.
When he left General Motors. Well, he was contacted by the Raymond Loewy Association, headquartered in New York, of course.
They picked a reason?
Well, they had gained the Studebaker account for design as well as International Truck. And then, of course, they were rapidly gaining accounts as well as Pennsylvania Railroad, Coca-Cola, people like that, large accounts. And industrial design was becoming a very important thing by this time. And so.
Loewy had come up through.
He had come up,
design.
Pardon?
He'd come up through the industrial design matrix.
Well, more or less. Actually, he started off sort of in fashion design
bit,
and then more or less got into designing storefronts in Chicago in particular. And he had a little bit of experience himself as far as having a car design with Hupmobile. And again, it was with Frank Hershey had been with him during that period of time, and had a little bit of experience there. Then made more or less contact with Studebaker and picked up their account. They had no in-house design in any way at Studebaker. They were, of course, still
pretty much old-fashioned.
Still pretty old-fashioned and
body engineers.
That's right.
Loewy had worked with the Pennsylvania Railroad.
Yes.
And had become very famous with that.
With the locomotive design, yes.
That's
with,
I was seeing that primarily.
That's right. And initially, they were looking for people to be able to handle these accounts, and he was gaining more accounts than he was able to service. That's what it amounted to.
Okay.
And so he started to go on a talent search, and it took him to General Motors first off, where within a very short period of time, I believe Claire Hodgman was the first to go, Paul Zimmerman, and then my father.
Wow.
And so
we
got all three of them right off the bat to go to New York. Well, it took a little bit of while. Claire got there first, and my dad kept in touch with him as, you know, how do you like it there and whatnot, mm-hmm. Okay, everything's fine, what are you working on, that type of thing. Besides, he got twice as much money offered, and that was a big deal. And then the chance to go to New York and live in around the big city and everything was
irresistible.
Oh, a big, big thing, made my mother gleefully happy, and my father was happy about the whole thing, he always had a penchant for travel. Interest, curiosity about what other people did. Even back in the early days, they'd always taken trips with my grandparents back to Pennsylvania. That's where their relatives were from. On my father's side, the Exners were Pennsylvania Dutch originally, more or less. And my grandmother herself was Holland Dutch. I mean Holland Michigan
right.
Dutch,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and
real Dutch.
And so my father had been taken on quite long automobile trips during that time, but had never been west of Chicago, and until he started to come up, then came up to Detroit, of course, and had never been. Well, he had been to Pennsylvania, but he'd never been to New York. So it was a big, big deal. My mother was game and always sporty and always ready to travel and had fun at it. They were very young at the time. He was the youngest head of a design studio in General Motors history. And at the time,
how young was he when he assumed the Pontiac?
Let's see, if that was 1935, 36, he was 26,
So it's off to the big city. And
so then 1938, he accepted, and like I said, he had told me this was years afterwards. I was only four.
Oh, you're only four.
Five at that time. And those were my earliest recollections myself, really, about a lot of this. I guess I can vaguely remember my dad had a 1933 Ford. That was when he first came up to General Motors. He got a 33 Ford. And then and that was just before he came up to General Motors that he traded the Model A in on that. Got the green 33 Ford, and I can vaguely remember coming back. I was dragged back and forth myself from Detroit to South Bend or to Buchanan many, many times during that period of time to go back down and visit our family and whatnot.
Right.
And I just, to hear my mother tell it, and I don't know why I remember these things, but by the time I was about 2 or 3 years old, my parents told me that I knew every car that was on the road,
really?
Coming up and down the road. And at any rate, the next big milestone that I ran, I remember a couple of things, of course, I remember the kids that I played with and whatnot, and I had my little race cars. I'd run on the front stoop of the apartment that we lived in on Ohio Street and around the New Center area there.
Okay, yeah.
And we lived in an upper flat, and the people that lived below had a couple little girls they used to play with.
Uh-huh.
And the Hoax, their name was. And
H-O-A-K.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. And we lived in a little upper flat. And I remember my daddy bringing home his new 1938 Pontiac. My mother telling me, now look out the window. You're going to see your daddy designed the car. You're going to see him drive it up to the driveway. And I remember watching for that. That was a big, big thrill. It was maroon, and it was a four-door. And this was in early 1938. And then shortly after that is when he accepted the position with Lowy, and we packed up and traveled east. And that car was a lousy car, but it was. He never liked that car. And
the Pontiac or the Ford?
The Pontiac, yeah.
Oh, wow.
The Pontiac, yeah, right.
Wow.
Yeah. He got rid of the Ford. He had the pressure on him by General Motors, of course.
Yeah.
And got a little tiny bit of a break on it,
but
and he was very proud of the fact that it was his design and whatnot. But he never liked the car. We went to Florida once when we lived in New York with him. Oh, that was just unbelievable. But at any rate.
Where did you finally end? Where did you finally live in New York?
Well, okay. Then we went to initially to Long Island.
Right.
And
typical.
Yes, at that time it was developing out on the island, and we went to
Robert Moses was carving out all those wonderful parks out there.
Yeah, that's right. And we lived in Amityville. Rented a house there. And
later famous for other things.
Yeah, right. That's right. But
very nice though.
It was very nice. I had a kind of a funny looking little house built around the green, and the house was a little bit older house, but it was all brick and everything. And during that fall, and of course my father was working right in the city at Lowy's studio on. 33rd or 34th around Broadway, someplace around Broadway in there. I'm not sure what the studios were at that time. But his initial assignments were to kind of help out with Paul Zimmerman and Claire together, work out some of the railroad car, passenger train car. Designs, and he got involved in a little bit of architectural layout there with some of that work. And he said he always told me that was a lot of fun. He liked to do that, but his major interest was cars. And Lowy very shortly assigned him to work on two projects: one, the One of the first projects was the 1938-39 International Truck design, and the second project was Studebaker. Was being that Studebaker was more and more or less demanding that they send somebody down there constantly to work with their engineers to work on the Studebaker designs.
Well, right back home.
Well, yeah, right back home. All right, and so. Boy, realized that my dad knew South Bend very well and everything else, and so
certainly Lowy didn't know South Bend.
Well, not too well, no.
Not that
well enough, but nevertheless, so he started to send my father down to Fort Wayne, where International Truck was, mm-hmm. and to work up, do a little bit of finish up work that they had there. Actually, I think he designed one of the front ends for one of the trucks at that time. More important was Studebaker, and he started literally with by 1939, he started to literally commute down there for a week at a time every 3 weeks, and it was a rigorous type of thing. Meanwhile, my mother and I
take the midnight flyer home.
Yeah, the train. Many times I was sent along with him because of my grandparents when I was, especially during the summer and whatnot, when I was out of school. I started school in Amityville in 1938, and that fall of 38, as a matter of fact, one of the big events in our lives. My father was down. In New York, in the offices in New York, and the hurricane hit in September, I believe it was September of 1938, that hit Long Island. It was a big one. It killed 500 people,
and it hit Amityville.
It uprooted some trees that I remember in our neighborhood, and it flooded our basement. And my mother and I were scared to death. We were there alone. My father was stuck in the city and commuted at that time at all times, and it was no electricity and stuff like that. It was quite a harrowing experience, but at any rate, that's just one of the things I remember at 5 years old. And so then he started to commute all the time. The Amityville residence was temporary until we until we built a house in Port Washington, Long Island. And that's where they and actually Raymond Lowy lived right near there himself also, the folks built a house in a new subdivision, very nice and whatnot, it was actually the first house that they built themselves, we lived temporarily in a little apartment in halfway in between the time that they rented the house and moved into the new house while it was being built.
Did you have siblings at this time?
No, not until 1940. My brother was born. Yeah. And at any rate, so...
Port Washington.
And during that period of time, my father more or less, like I say, commuted back and forth to Studebaker, and it got to be a kind of a treadmill type situation. But we held out until about 1940, and my brother was born in 1940 there in Port Washington, and we only lived there for a short period of time after that, and Studebaker was beginning to demand that that they needed to have a in-house design section, and a resident, there needed to be a resident designer there, because they could work together much better that way.
Now before 1940, did your father have any direct influence on the first 39?
Yes, of course. He got in the tail end of the 1939 champion,
right.
Of which he was quite proud to have been associated with, because it was, he had developed a philosophy of even liking smaller cars and liking European cars and the influence there and whatnot.
Can you reconstruct from your knowledge of those events how that was put together? You say he got in the tail end of the design?
He got in the tail end of the overall design. Mm-hmm. I think he managed to do a little bit of cleaning up and just a little bit of detailing. But the basic formula was already happened, really. I suppose, I think Claire Hoschman had a bit to do with it, and probably something that Studebaker themselves had put forth, that type of a formula, that type of a package, the 109-inch wheelbase, which is considerably smaller than full-size cars. The standard full-size wheelbase in those days was 115 inches, 115, 116 was the, with 56-inch tread, and was the standard size car. But the Studebaker was a, it was unique from that standpoint, that it was the short wheelbase, a smaller car, a very nice little six-cylinder engine, a small engine, and very efficient automobile.
I can remember it very well as a teenager. I thought it was special.
Oh, they were neat. We finally got one ourselves, and or the closest. Yeah, we finally had one ourselves during that period of time. Then my father managed to get a little discount from Studebaker, so we had a Commander at one time, then a Champion, then a President, 1941 President.
Wow, you're really
that was yeah, that was nice.
Tell but, me, forgive me for interrupting. Mm-hmm. Do you looking back on this, you obviously gave it a lot of thought, and you obviously absorbed a lot of it from your experiences with your father and elsewhere. How did the Lowy setup work there? Lowy was the New York guru, and of course he had talented people.
Well, he owned the company, of course, overall.
He negotiated the contract.
Negotiated the contracts.
Very talented people like yourself, yeah. Mr. Hodgman, Mr. Zimmerman.
Right.
Did he give them their head? Did he allow them to?
Pretty much, yes. He demanded that they not work for anybody else or anything like that.
Exactly.
That he had the final decisions about things when he was available.
That was a problem.
It was a great problem. He sat back and raked in the dough and paid them quite well, but even a couple of fudged on expense accounts. I mean, even literally,
yeah.
I remember my father telling me about this. I can only relate this as
being true,
my dad knew that he had submitted his expense accounts, and he tried to be very honest about the whole thing, and Lowy would take a cut on him. Studebaker told my dad this, that Lowy was taking a cut off of this, that you should have more coming to you than what, and we're paying him more than what he's giving you.
The combination of ego, his European background, and his need for a success in the automobile industry led him to somewhat autocratic.
Quite autocratic. Actually, though, he liked cars.
Mm-hmm.
He really didn't know that much about them, and
right.
he was a more of an entrepreneur, business. It was a type that really did it. Great thing overall.
Like they say today, you put together a package.
Put together a package, promoted the idea of industrial design, and provided a service, did the overall managing of the services. And
did have a talented cadre of.
Very much so. Build up a great a section of designers for these other accounts, as well as my father himself hired a great number of talented people when he was sent down to Studebaker to finally make the in-house Lowy account down there for Studebaker and build up a staff of very good designers.
So even though Lowy did not designate much authority, it early became apparent that your father would be the leader of the
Studebaker account. That was more or less intimated at that time that he would. And so that's what happened. And Studebaker more or less demanded that he come down there, that Lowy put somebody in down there, and build up the styling section down there to service the account. So that's what happened.
It was a very great success in the early.
Yeah, it was. It was. In 1940, we moved back down to South Bend.
Oh,
and the housing shortage, of course, at that time was was tremendous, and the war was imminent, and there was a tremendous housing shortage in South Bend, and we wound up being rented the little guest house on the Paul G. Hoffman estate.
Oh, really?
Of course, Paul G. Hoffman was the president of Studebaker at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a cute little house, very cold,
but
it was in the middle of alfalfa fields and on Don Moyer Street in South Memphis. So,
what's the name of the street?
Don Moyer Street.
Don Moyer?
Don Moyer, D-O-N-M-O-Y-E-R, all one word. I don't know who. But but it was on the south side of South Bend, and, right attached to, actually physically attached to the not the house itself, but the property was all attached to the Paul G. Hoffman estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lived there in 1940, 1941.